There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Matt Cain, Editor-in-Chief of Attitude, and welcome to our 10th installment of Attitude Heroes, the only podcast that puts prominent British gay men in the spotlight for a whole hour. We've got a treat for you today as I'm joined by a very chatty Mark Armand. We talk about his music, his sexual awakening, the homophobia he's experienced, how he's dealt with it, and much, much more. It's a great listen. A quick reminder that Attitude Heroes is sponsored by the Great Britain Campaign, which welcomes the world to visit, do business, invest, and study in the UK. You can check out their website at great.gov.uk. And our co-sponsors are Jaguar. If you'd like more information on their products, then you can visit the website jaguar.co.uk or look out for them in the latest issue of Attitude magazine. If, like me, you grew up watching Top of the Pops in the 80s, you probably still have memories of Mark Armand dressed all in black and covered in bangles. His band Soft Cell had several top 10 hits with songs like Tainted Love, Bedsitter and Say Hello, Wave Goodbye. Later, he reached number one duetting with Gene Pitney on Something's Gotten Hold of My Heart. And as a solo artist, he's released more than 20 albums, selling a total of over 30 million records worldwide. He's never left anyone in any doubt about his sexuality, and that sometimes made him a target for abuse, rumour and outright slut-shaming. When we met, he told me that prejudice was something he'd been dealing with for a very long time, even within his own family. Coming up, we'll hear what happened when his father marched into school with an angry order for his teacher.
He marched in to see her one day, demanded to see her. My father says, "I demand to know if my son is a homosexual." And everything, drunk.
And he'll tell me about some of the names that have been used against him.
So Puff, queer was always said with a spit and always said with a sneer. So I can't adopt those words for myself. I'm glad other people have been able to, but I'm not able to adopt them for myself. And I don't like being called queer and I don't like being called a puff.
He'll also reveal how hard he finds it to say the word gay, at least with one family member.
I've never, ever once in my life with my mother said the G word.
We met at his record company offices to celebrate the launch of his new album, Shadows and Reflections, which is out now and a brilliant listen. There are a few rude words in our conversation, but I'll admit most of them come from me. So, now that you've been suitably warned, let's meet Mark. Okay. Mark, thank you for having us. We're here in your record company's offices.
Yeah, very glamorous. I mean, this is the first time I've been on a major label since sometime back in the 90s. I think that last major label I was thinking was on Mercury Universal. And finally, at my time of life, I'm back on a major label again after doing my own thing, what I wanted to do for the past few years. I'm kind of back owned by a record company again.
And you've got the new album, which is, I absolutely love it.
Thank you.
But what's interesting is, it's kind of, some of the tracks have quite sad names and it's all quite joyful and jolly. And I don't know if jolly is the right word, actually, but it's lovely and sweet and adorable.
Well, it's kind of, but all the lyrics are really miserable.
Yeah.
So basically, that's the kind of pop I like. I like bittersweet pop stuff that's kind of sounds happy and poppy on the outside. But when you listen to the music, it's the lyrics are utterly kind of miserable. And I thought, well, I could do an album of standards, you know, the usual songs that everybody sings on those records of standards, or I could try and do a torch song album of great 60s orchestral pop.
But it's interesting as well, if you think about during a lot of your career, you've reworked other artists' songs and made them your own. What is it that you enjoy about that? Why do you keep coming back to that? Because some artists hardly ever do covers, do they?
I just don't think I'm a good enough songwriter, is the similar to that. I mean, I think I can sometimes come up with a gem. Sometimes I can write songs. I feel like I go through periods of sometimes I write good songs, sometimes I write songs because I feel I have to, sometimes I write songs and I just can't get it together. But, this album, it's referring to songs that I listened to a lot when I was very, very young growing up. When I was a kid, from 1963, I was about 5 years old. And my parents were quite young, and I watched all the pop shows on TV, Ready, Steady, Go, Thank You, Lucky Stars, the usual thing, Jukebox Jury, and my parents watched them, listened to the radio all the time. So all those songs were imprinted from songs of the 60s. So that's the kind of decade that I keep going back to. I remember it really well. I remember the songs really well, the artists I remember really well. So that's the decade I keep coming back to. And I just love these songs. I feel that a lot of these songs are quite darker love songs. They have a dark edge to them. And I like songs like that that have this dark sort of edge that I can kind of bring. They're not happy-go-lucky sort of songs. They could have a great orchestration and some pop sound, but they're real kind of angsty sort of gothic songs.
But interestingly, actually, when you talk about how you discovered this music, it was, I almost said it was imposed on you by your parents, but it was their choice of music rather than yours. When you started choosing your own music when you were a teenager, say, I always think that's a really crucial period of someone's life. And particularly gay men can be really attached to that music that they grow up with at that in that period of their lives. And the music that you chose to listen to, am I right in thinking it was quite different from
when I first started buying records was the beginning, was the late 60s, beginning of this very, very like 1970. And then the period was, it was kind of blues rock. And I kind of liked all that at the time. And then that started to gradually shift and change, and you started to get more... The glam rock came in with things like the Bolans and the Bowie and Roxy Music. I remember reading about Roxy Music and New Musical Express before I'd even heard them. Heard about this band called Roxy Music, and they just looked fantastic. You know, they had
so much of it was
Eno,
the look, wasn't it? The design and the
Fairy with this cliff, and they wore these kind of like amazing sort of like things. And yeah, so that kind of drew me away from kind of progressive rock, and it re-educated me musically into kind of more simpler pop of glam rock and kind of almost three chord rock. Of pop music at that time. And when you first saw Mark Bolan came on the television, it was in black and white TV, but it was like a world of colour. It was like something that you've not seen before. It was like something from another planet. It's hard to really describe that now.
But interesting that you should say that. Do you think the fact that you maybe you weren't so attached to this planet and the world you were living in, do you think that's partly why it appealed so much?
Oh, yeah. It showed me like a doorway to another... There was another world out there that I didn't really know about.
You were looking for another world.
I was looking for... I was at school in Leeds at the time. You know, but it kind of showed me like... a world that was outside Leeds, and it was full of androgyny and glitter, and it was somebody wearing these kind of clothes that were sort of slightly androgynous. I mean, I think we all kind of knew in our heart at that time, because I was always friends with the girls at school. We always kind of kept
with
them.
Well, we're old, darling.
but I did have some friends with them, because I mean, school was actually a kind of interesting time for me, because... Yeah, I was bullied a bit at school at first. And I was real, when I started secondary school, it was a real fear that I was going to have my head stuck down the toilet and have the flush pulled and things like that, and we're going to be totally kind of beaten up. And it was a bit like that at first. It was fearful. But then I kind of discovered school could be quite good, because I kind of became a bit bad at school. I behaved really badly at school because I had learning difficulties at school. They were my main fear. So I behaved really badly to cover that up. I made friends with the girls, and... Like people did at that time, you had imaginary girlfriends that no one ever saw.
Yeah.
They lived in another town or lived there somewhere else, but they never saw. You know, nobody.
Can't do that now with Facebook and everything. But, can you? The girls don't have that.
No,
luxury.
They don't. But some of the boys at school tapped into the fact that you were gay, or there was something that, and they tapped into the fact that they could experiment with you.
Oh my God! So I thought you were going to say that they had to go at you about it, but
no,
they
didn't. School became quite good. I behaved kind of badly, so I got boys on my side. I was friends with the girls. We went to T-Rex concerts with the girls, but yet I kind of, it was a great time for me, because certain boys who were kind of curious at that time. And honestly, we were all very, you know, we were probably, I was probably 13 or 14 at that time. And that's when I had my first boyfriends.
Oh my God. Fantastic.
In fact, I had my first boyfriend when I was 11. And I had my first boyfriend the same age as me. Boyfriend is the wrong thing to call it.
How did that boyfriendness express itself? Did you kiss? Did you hold
hands? Yeah, we just kissed each other, yeah. We kissed each other. And we wanted to be, it wasn't sexual. It wasn't. didn't have that kind of thing. It was just a lot of kissing, a lot of kind of close... he was the same age as me. I should emphasise that, really. And, he was the same age as me. He was another boy at school. And we became very, very close and we kissed each other and we were very, very close together and we were together all the time until his parents told me that I couldn't hang around with him anymore.
Because they noticed the nature of the bond.
They noticed something.
You know what I always found fascinating is when you're that age and when it's, well, in those days when it was so unspoken, when you fancied somebody, you had no idea whether they fancied you or how they'd respond. Can you remember the fear of when you first kissed him? Or
we went on a school trip to London and we stayed in this hotel in Paddington. There was about 11. We all went down to see things like Hampton Court and all these sort of things like that.
And you were snugging one of the boys.
And we all had to share about four or five beds in a room. And I had to share this bed with him. And it just happened, you know, it just happened in the night. And it's just closeness. But the funny thing was the other boys in the room knew it was happening, didn't care at all. Didn't bother at all.
So do you think that's
bother me about it, didn't bully me about it, didn't go anything about it. In fact, one of them, the boys, it attracted him to want to do the same thing to me later, about a year later.
Oh my God, you had an amazing time.
I did. School was fantastic. Once I got past all the bullying stage and everything.
Can I just say that, right? So you describe these boys as curious. So have they gone on to be straight men?
I don't know. That I have no idea.
You've never looked them up on social media.
I did once, about 9-10 years ago, look somebody up on social media. I went to a school reunion out of curiosity. And the boy that I had a crush on was there at the school reunion. And we kind of, I told him I had a crush on him at school.
And what did he say?
He was really flattered. And it was about 15, 16 years ago. But I told him then, I said, I was mad about you when I was at school. I was really crush on you and everything. And he loved it. He was really, really excited. He said, oh, you should have told me.
He
was kind of married and everything with kids. And it was kind of funny because all the friends I knew, most of them at that school reunion, the ones I'd had any kind of dalliance with weren't there at that particular school reunion. But there were other people that were in my class, and it was quite curious because they'd all got married or had some jobs. They all got fat, really fat. They all lost all the hair. They'd all got kind of fat, you know, everything. So it's like marriage and kids kill.
But also, Mark, if you heard that saying, one of my favourite sayings is early to ripe, early to rot.
Yeah, yeah.
The ones who were hot and beautiful when they're young, they go to shit.
Absolutely true. It was absolutely true.
Whereas the ugly ducklings have to learn social skills have to learn to entertain people and have to learn how to make something of themselves.
That is so true. And they become kind of really middle-aged and really kind of like, you know, like married life had kind of ruined them.
Worn them down.
But it was kind of curious. Yeah, obviously, it was looking nice and, you know, and his wife was there and everything. And she was going, oh, yeah, you know. If only he had looked after himself. I just thought it was just beautiful at school.
But it's
beautiful
interesting. So your school, so these boys who you were getting off with this other boy in bed and all the other ones were fine about it. So do you think they had not yet learnt homophobia?
No, I think that's true. I think they hadn't. That school I went to in Leeds, a mixed school, I didn't have a lot of bullying there. I did a little bit of teasing more than bullying, I should say. When I went to an all-boys school, when we left Leeds and my parents got divorced, I went back to live in Southport, I went to an all-boys school then. And then it was a little bit more kind of, they're a bit older and it was a bit kind of more sort of like, a bit more than teasing. It was kind of just pestering generally kind of, it got a bit more kind of heavier. I can't say I ever got really beaten up. I got pushed around and stuff. Never got beaten up, but got pushed around a bit. But I found there were other boys. Then I would have been about 15 or 16. And there were other boys in my class who I recognised. Then you could recognise that there were other definite gay boys.
Did you think in your head other gays, or did you just think they're like me?
They're kind of like me. We like David Bowie, we like Mark Bolan, we like Roxy Music, we like listening to records. And then I found that coincided with a time when my mother did divorce. We were living near the school. So I found it was very easy for me to go into school in registration in the daytime, go home, come back in the afternoon to registration in the afternoon, go home, and occasionally attend a few classes like art and English that I really liked and everything. And then we used to go back with another couple of boys at the school and play kind of records at their house and things like
smoke
that.
Smoke fags.
Yeah, yeah, smoke fags and play records and things like that. And they were other boys that I've still known since. And I know one of those boys I still know really, really well. I'm still friends with and still see from time to time now.
And was he... Did any of these boys turn out to be gay, or was it just that other and being...
No, they did. The boy who I'm in touch with now, from time to time. In fact, both of them actually, they both turned out to be gay. But then it was kind of weird because we were 15 and 16, but we kind of accepted that we were gay in a way.
See, it's interesting.
We kind of loved it because it was kind of clandestine. It was sort of like we had this private little club, and sometimes we could bring other people into that club as well. Other people would kind of come into it that we kind of like. That we kind of would come round to say, oh, I'll come round and play records with you, and come round to your house after school, and we'd play with them, and not play with them literally sexually, but just tease them and things like that, and they kind of loved it, you know.
So it's interesting, you know, because by the time I was growing up in the 80s, the AIDS crisis had happened, and it whipped up so much hysteria and homophobia that kind of thing, you know, if I identified any other gays at school, I had to steer clear because. They'd drag me down further. Do you know what's that expression that a drowning person never holds on to another drowning person?
You
go down quicker together.
Yeah.
It was such a horrible thing.
I bet it must have been at that time, actually. It must have been a very, very difficult time at that time.
Whereas the time that you're growing up, you're talking around gay, I suppose. I know it's a bit
early 70s. I'm talking about. Very early 70s.
Yes, it is gay liberation.
End of the 60s, 69, and it was still kind of, it was much more kind of, we were much more naive, I think, but naively kind of free about it. Lads kind of, they did kind of tease you. I mean, I know some people probably in some places had terrible, when they went through bullying experiences, but I think that really happened, as you say, that really kind of got into a more darker time for young gay people around the early 80s, I think. I mean, it was a dark time for gay people a lot of the time in the 80s.
Well, it's also, you've got that thing where when you get more visibility and more rights, as visibility grows, the backlash can grow because there's something to have a backlash against. Yeah. Whereas in those days, I suppose there was nothing that was as threatening about it. By the time I'm growing up, people used to play Tig in the playground. You'd catch AIDS if they caught you.
Yeah, that's terrible.
All these horrible, you know. Whereas you're growing up in that kind of golden period when gay liberation is happening before the AIDS crisis.
It is. And when I left home, I was 17. I went to art college. I was lucky enough to go to art college. Once you're at art college, nobody cares at all. You can be as gay as you like in art college. Nobody cares at all. I had my first proper real boyfriend at art college, who I was kind of real kind of mean to, actually, because I was discovering that time where I could kind of go out to clubs and go with different people. Even that was at the end of the 70s in Leeds. And
so what was the gay scene like in Leeds?
Well, it was really kind of like knock on the door. It was a place called Charlie's, where you had to go up some stairs and knock on the door. And it actually had one of those square dance floors, the other dance floors with the squares that light up. And everything. And it was kind of really rough. It was kind of, you had to go on the door, are you gay? Yeah, you know, you can come in. And it was still kind of like clandestine. Even then, it was still knock on the door and, you know, and things like that.
So when you were in there, were you frightened or were you kind of enjoying
it? Oh, no, I loved it. It was all really rough Leeds Rent boys and I remember really rough lesbians as well.
Oh, really?
And I remember one lesbian saying she had mild tattooed on one breast and bitter tattooed on the other breast. She said, guess where the lager is. So it's like it was great. All these sort of underworldy gay people in Leeds. It was fantastic. But then of course there was the art college thing where you'd have the art college scene where it was just all mixed gays and straights. Everybody was, you could be as gay as you wanted at art college, you know. So in fact, the only people that kind of I got bullied by, not bullied, but actually taken the piss by were the tutors, actually. A couple of the macho tutors who were there, who were like real sort of painters and real sort of artists, you know, there were these sort of sculptor painters going, you know, kind of like, oh, you know, they were all kind of, it was jokes about, oh, here come the bum boys and things like that. And so they were the only ones, it was the older tutors that were really kind of homophobic.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of real Yorkshire kind of, art, you know, kind of, sort of tutors, and they were kind of, they were kind of joking. But that, I mean, because you could say that then, you could say people say you didn't take that offence of it then, because you, I was used to that. I was used to that. You know.
Yeah, but sure. I think it's still just as offensive. It's just that we had to be pathetically grateful for any level of acceptance that we
exactly
just didn't object.
Yeah, well, exactly.
To make jokes,
yeah, we didn't mind it. At all, you know.
It's terrible, isn't it? What we had to put up with is the norm.
Well, it is really. It's still, you know, and people readopted the word queer, but it still makes me shudder whenever
I hear it.
I can't use it to myself.
So many.
You've got to be queer. And yeah. I just can't, I'm sorry. For my time, it just meant a different thing. It was always
people
said with a spit and a nasty of, you know.
So many people I've spoken to on this podcast have said the same thing, and I feel the same thing. Puff as well, actually.
Yeah, I don't like that. That's even worse, because there's something kind of very... It says you're very kind of like passively powder puff. You're kind of camp powder puff, you know. You're sort of like something that's kind of a kind of a, I don't know, there's something very kind of insulting about it, isn't it? You're just... to be gay, you have to be just a really... Femme powder puff.
It's completely emasculating you, trying to disempower you.
Emasculating you, that's what it is. So puff, queer was always said with a spit and always said with a sneer. So I can't adopt those words for myself. I'm glad that the people have been able to, but I'm not able to adopt them for myself. And I don't like being called queer and I don't like being called a puff.
But interestingly, you're talking about that time and it's...
I've called myself it in a song, but in an ironic sort of way.
That's allowed, though. We're allowed to do it between ourselves. But so it's interesting, this picture that you're painting of his time, because it sounds lovely and kind of, apart from the
tunes... No, I've got roasting his spectacles on, really.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, because I've read about some of the performance art that you did at Art College, and some of it sounded
quite angry and confrontational.
So what were you angry about then?
I've always been a bit angry. I think I was very angry... I don't know, I think my main anger came from my father. I think it all stemmed from him, because my father was an alcoholic bully. He was an alcoholic, a quite violent person. He marched into school one day. This is when I was in Leeds, when I must have been about 14, 13 or 14. And he knew I liked art. And he had an art teacher called Miss Green, who was, she had all sort of afro-y hair, and she was all kind of wearing, well, kind of crochets and things. Like an art teacher and round glasses. And he marched in to see her one day, demanded to see her. My father says, I demand to know if my son is a homosexual. And everything, drunk. And I was called into the head's office and said, you know, your father's been here causing trouble and wanting to know if you're homosexual. Are you? And I said, well, I just was flabbergasted, you know. I said, of course not, you know. So, everything.
And
you
do, you?
That's
13,
your main reaction.
You
I'm about 13, yeah. So my anger, I think, comes from something that stems from home life more than school life. But also, I think you're bound to be scarred by the times. You know, even though I can be put on my roasting spectacles and say, yeah, I did have some good times at school. But it was an underlying fear, I think, with all of it. All the time.
Well, that your dad could...
Well, not my dad, but the thing is that you knew that you weren't right like everybody else. You felt you weren't right. You were like an outsider. You weren't clicking into everybody else. And you always felt... I remember when I kind of... I ran away from school. I was at school and I was at the games teacher was trying to force me to go in goals or something awful like that. I'm ridiculous. And then I ran away from school and they chased after me, the games teacher. They came looking, I'd hidden in some woods nearby and they came finding me. And they just bullied me and pushed me around so much, the sort of games teachers. And that was the only really kind of real bullying I experienced at school was from the PE teachers and games teachers, because I wouldn't play games as good as the other boys.
Interesting.
Not from the boys, but from the teachers.
I suppose it's a different thing. If you feel despised by your peer group, that can be a really damaging thing. Whereas if you feel rejected by adults, you can just rebel against the adults.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a normal thing for a teenager, isn't it?
It's also that thing as well, you know, I mean, I'm saying that, you know, that though I did have some good times at school and gravitated, if anyone ever would ask you, are you gay, to know. I've got a girlfriend, you know, and so all this messing about you do with other boys was just messing about. It was they felt they didn't want to be called queer or whatever. You didn't want to be called queer. It was just kind of, it's just things that happened. You know, you'd go on, you'd be on cross country with another boy, and you'd be running and everything, and you'd stop off at something, and then something would happen, and they kind of, whether it was kind of gravity because they knew I'd be recipient in something like that, but they were never called gay or never called, you never referred to them as being a gay thing, or a, you know, it was because you if anyone else found out, you'd be a queer.
All right then. So if you had, if you went from that kind of playing around with boys and not talking about it, how did you make the progression from that to the first boyfriend that you mentioned?
In an art college.
So it's just that you went to art college and suddenly.
Just I went to art college and I really liked him. He was always on his own. I remember how it happened. It was my first year at art college, and it was 1976, the winter of 1976. And it was snowing in Leeds.
Oh, it sounds like one of your songs.
Yes, I know. And it was snowing very hard. And I lived in this basement sort of bedsit, really, that was awful. I was chatting with him in the studio. It was just in the art college studio. There was just the two of us. And I said, come back to my house and we'll listen to music. And, you know, and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'll just come home and listen to music. We could have some wine and things like that.
What music did you play while you
David Bowie's Low, side two. Of Low.
You still remember?
Yeah, I do remember. And we shared this bottle of wine together, and I just kissed him. And and we had a candlelight, and it was really quite romantic. And I kissed him, and he stayed the night. And then it lasted quite a while. But then I kind of felt he was getting a bit bored by it. You see what I mean? I felt that he was kind of, yeah. because he moved into my house. We moved into another house. He moved into my house. I felt it was kind of drifting apart, slightly drifting apart, drifting away. I started to meet other friends by then, other gay friends by then, who I'd not really met before. So I kind of started sabotaging it in a way, by being a bit mean to him, trying to drive him away. I think which was what I was trying to do. He even came home to stay with my house in Southport. He visited home for Christmas. Oh. My mother was she was like, she knew exactly what was going on.
See, I wanted to ask you about your mum, because I know your dad was Scottish and military, but your mum was Norwegian.
He was Scottish, had a whole Scottish ancestry. He wasn't. I think my mum was Norwegian from my grandfather's side. My grandfather was Norwegian.
The only reason I ask about that is because we quite often think of Scandinavians as being much more liberal when it comes to gay people. And I wondered whether your mum's liberal views might have offset your dad's illiberal ones.
I don't know. My mother is very liberal now. But I say liberal. She is liberal because she loves... She just loves being part of all, you know, gay things. but she never ever... I've never ever once in my life... with my mother, said the G word.
Oh, really?
Never mentioned the word gay.
Mark, you never come out to your mum?
My mother. Well, it had to come out. It's not bloody obvious. You know, even when I've had a boyfriend there or something like that.
So you still can't say... Right, so...
But we just never, ever say the G word. And when she mentions about things like, oh, people get, you know, boys get married these days, I change the subject instantly. I still feel that I'm... in the power of my mother, 11 years old, and have to kind of pretend that I've got girlfriends.
When your dad was being very anti-gay with you, a lot of people, their mum is a defender. She steps in and makes the peace and is on their side with a lot of gay boys. Was your mum this kind of figure for you, or did she not?
No.
So did you resent her for that?
I did, yeah. I did resent. It's not that she didn't stand up for me. She was going through a very bad time herself with my father. She was too busy. We were too busy standing up for my mother than anything else. Me and my sister. But she didn't. And my mother was very. My mother would use phrases I was growing up like so and so's a pansy and so and so's a so and so's a puff and so and so's a bit light of foot and limp of knee, you know, and so. But it was weird. You know, it was always that thing when a gay comedian comes on the television, or a sort of like a camp comedian comes on the television.
You remember everything that's
said. You just sit there with sweat running down your back. You just your face just goes so red. There's a silence that you can just cut with a knife in the room, and the sweat runs down your back, and you go, everyone's going.
But isn't it fascinating that, you know, your mum is now really liberal and loves being around the gays, but those comments must have made such an impact on you that you still can't forget them, and you still can't say
they did make a huge scarring impact that even at my age, I still can't. I still... Isn't that terrible?
It's not terrible. I think it's good that you can admit it because it's a fact of life. You know, because actually what you were saying about your first boyfriend and you were sabotaging it and pushing him away, do you not think some of that is how you've been made to feel about yourself?
But I've done
yourself?
That all my life. I've actually done that again and again and again many times over my life. And now it's the other way, or they've sabotaged me and pushed me away. But it's always been some form of sabotage.
So it's never necessarily... They've always been unhealthy relationships.
A lot of unhealthy relationships, yeah, over the years.
Do you think
not so much now. Not now. But there was for quite a while.
So do you see any connection between putting yourself into those unhealthy relationships and the way you were made to think about yourself as a dirty, disgusting queer?
Yeah. I think there must have been some connection there. I mean, it's very weird with my mother, but it's the same. I can very difficult to say the words to family members of mine. Well, to anybody, really. I can't say the words "I love you" to anybody.
Oh, right. So here's the thing. My mum and dad never used to say it to us, and I never said it to them.
I can't say it to anybody.
But the thing is, you've just said the words now. All you have to do is open your mouth and say them. I started saying it to my mum and dad about 10 years ago when I had a lot of therapy, and they didn't say anything back, and now they say it back. All you just said the words, I love you.
I know, I always go, lots of love, or, oh, lots of love to you. I always soften it with lots of love, or, oh, I love you to bits. Or lots of love. I can never say, but that's not just my fault. I can't say that to anybody.
Part of you felt unloved by them when you were growing up?
I think I did, yeah. I think I probably did. Actually, I felt an embarrassment, an unwanted and unloved embarrassment.
And the way you're made to feel about yourself, it stays with you.
Also, because I wasn't very good at school, because I had kind of learning difficulties at school, did dyslexia and concentrational problems and all those kind of things. So it's like kind of like low on the spectrum, whatever. And so I did terribly at school, apart from art and English. So then that was always okay. I always get thrashed by my father, shouted at by my mother, all those things as well. So I associate... I got told off a lot when I was and all that kind of violence that was kind of going on at the same time. So school would where is school? I was quite afraid at school inside, even though I was having to, but I was also quite afraid at home. So it was going from one fearful situation into another fearful situation. Though school was a relief compared to my
That's the wrong way around, isn't it? With me, school I was frightened of. When I went home, I felt safe. And that's
home was more frightening to me than being at school. So school was the lesser of the two frightenings. I mean, I got away. I used to go out. I was allowed to go out very early age to go to concerts, 12 or 13. I went on my own into Leeds to concerts. I got a job at a stables. So I escaped from home as often as I could. I ran away two or three times, but mostly for attention, really.
Okay, we're going to take a quick pause, and when we come back, I'm going to ask you about running away properly when you ran away, moved away to London.
Okay.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
It's time to get back to Mark. But first, a very quick reminder that Attitude Heroes is sponsored by the Great Britain Campaign, which welcomes the world to visit, do business, invest and study in the UK. You can check out their website at great.gov.uk. And our co-sponsors are Jaguar. If you'd like more information on their products, then you can visit the website jaguar.co.uk or look out for them in the latest issue of Attitude magazine.
Okay, so, Mark, we've talked about growing up and wanting to escape your unhappy home life. Can we talk now about when you did permanently escape and you went away and moved from art college in Leeds to London?
Well, I left art college and I was working in the bar at Leeds Playhouse. I was working a night in a disco called Leeds Warehouse, which was a disco in Leeds, to make money. I was living in a bedsit flat in Leeds. And I was going to Charlie's at night, this place, this in
the steps, knocking on the door,
and asking, you know, and everything. And I met this boy called Paul. This boy called Paul was just mesmerised by him. He was absolutely amazing. He looked like kind of young David Essex. He was absolutely fantastic. But he was a rent boy, basically. And he said, I'll take you down to London to meet all these to meet these people. And I was kind of fascinated because I was doing these little theatre things at art college and writing these little plays, things like that. I thought it'd be really interesting and fantastic. So he took me down to London I think it's the first day that I was there. We were arrested outside Cotone's restaurant and everything for loitering about on the street while he was making phone calls to various punters that he knew.
So they thought you were rent boy as well.
So basically, I kind of was tagging around with Paul and everything, meeting all these people that he was meeting. He kind of, but it, it the story of Paul is a dark and horrible story.
It sounds so Dickensian.
I got a job, and I got a job in a clip joint. A clip joint is somewhere where you go in and you pay money to somebody behind a desk, and they take you round to what is a strip club around the corner, where you're taken downstairs and given all this fake champagne for the cost of £100, then taken to a cash point where you're robbed.
No, I've heard basically. Of them. I've totally heard of them.
And that was
you
it.
Were one of these
so
fraudsters.
I worked in a clip joint. Where I take the money for the club ticket, they'd be taken around the corner, some place around the corner, Walker's Court, where they'd be taken downstairs and fleeced and everything. That was my first job down in London.
This is the '70s, and it sounds like Dickens.
It was about seventy nine, beginning of 80.
And so you'd been to gay bars in Leeds, but what did you... So you're discovering the underground in London and presumably the gay scene.
I mean, through Paul, I just met loads of amazing, strange, this whole underworld and everything that was kind of through him. He was just quite a nasty piece of work, really, but he was just a fascinating mesmer... And one of these people that you're just kind of instantly mesmerisingly attracted to.
So did you go out with him? Did you have a thing?
We had a thing with him, and then we went back to Leeds and he set my house on fire and nicked all my stuff. And then he came round to the Playhouse where I was working, because I wouldn't have anything to do with him anymore, and threw a dustbin through the plate glass window at the front. So that was the end of my relationship with Paul.
So when did you go from hanging out with rent boys and working in a clip joint to being an internationally successful pop star about
less than a couple of years after that, really?
Yeah, but in those days, correct me if I'm wrong, but I always thought the underground was kind of, there was a real link with creativity and that, you know, that art scene in the way that there isn't quite so much now, maybe.
Well, I kind of, I mean... Not really an artistic underground. It was more like a real. It was really. It was when Piccadilly was known as the Dilly.
Yeah.
And it was a very different.
There were rent boys just work
everywhere. Yeah. It was under the arches of Piccadilly Circus.
And was it kind of hot or was it just skanky and grim?
It was skanky and grim.
Was it?
Really,
and
yeah.
So the rent boys just took people back to a room somewhere,
or they'd be taken back to places. I mean, you meet all these kind of characters that were there. I mean, they were kind of like very kind of. I kind of found it very fascinating and interesting, but it was a world I didn't want to get drawn too much into. I kind of imagined myself as someone like, had this romantic idea of myself as someone like as a John Retchie or a John Genet or something like, where who would have these experiences and then go and write about them and write sort of like.
Well, Jean Genet was completely in it, wasn't he?
But it's kind of like you had this kind of romantic idea about it but it wasn't really. But I went back to Leeds and that's when I was kind of still hanging around the art college, and I'd already met Dave Ball. He was in the last year. Of when I left college, and we just I was kind of hanging around with people there, and we just decided I'd worked with Dave before because I know he had all these keyboards and things. When I was at the college, he'd done all these soundtracks to my performance shows about going down to London and things like that and meeting these kind of people. And then we just decided, I think in the end of 78, something like that, we decided to kind of start some sort of a band or something, and that's how it starts. Soft Cell first started.
But it's interesting that you were very, you know, your artistic inclinations were very underground and not very mainstream.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying your sound was mainstream with Soft Cell actually, but you went so big so quickly, didn't you?
It was the explosion at that time of electronic. I mean, it was the Human League that had things like Being Boiled, things like that, very kind of early. It was all that very kind of northern electronic scene of Human League, Cabaret Voltaire. And it was the very early days of electronic music, very post-punk, really. And Soft Cell were like a post-punk band. Mm. We were really just extension of Art College, really. We did these kind of very kind of like, we wrote all these songs about consumerist nightmares and suburbia. And things
sort of
like
a bit idealistic student politics.
And it was just student, but kind of, it was kind of like the bizarre, darker side of suburbia, and you know, people having Tupperware parties and swingers parties and things like that. But they were like adverts. They were like strange things. And so that's how Soft Cell first started, as like this art college band. Our first gig was in the common room at the art college. We used films and projections, and we were like a real extension of what I'd been doing at art college with performance and experimental theatre, and what Dave had been doing with his artwork. We had somebody working projections for us, because we'd heard the Human League did something very similar. And we started just getting more and more gigs, and it was that early days of that music, and our songs became more and more like pop songs, and it just mutated more and more into more of a pop sort of feel.
As you became a big pop act and Tainted Love blew up everywhere, how did the records... We're here in your current record company's offices, it's all very glam, and, you know, how did your record company at the time respond to... your gayness? Did they want you to cover it up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Or? I mean, it was just one battle with us. We're working with a major record label. We were art students that had come out of... I'd come out of 5 years at art college. Dave had done 3 years at art college. We kind of... We came from an underground into a corporate world because we were signed for a tiny little deal to Universal, because they wanted to have any electronic band signed at that time, you know, to get their own electronic band. We were signed a deal, but we had this little song called Tainted Love, which was a song that we discovered was a Northern Soul song.
Gloria Jones song.
And we were playing it at our gigs as an encore number, you know, a cold electronic band doing a Northern Soul song. And they loved it, and that's how that kind of catapulted, well, the whole, you know, the whole story of Northern, of the Tainted Love, how that all sort of catapulted very, very quickly into a successful record. But they just didn't know what to do with me at that time.
So what did they say you should do about your gayness?
Well, it was like you will be finished. If they find out you're gay, you'll be absolutely finished. Your career will be ruined. My first Top of the Pops experience changed my life completely. And as many people, I just said people want to either mother me, murder me, fuck me, or, you know, or whatever, you know.
All of the above.
Or all of the above. And especially the people that wanted to murder you, you know, all the kind of, as I can say, with that early 80s thing, it kind of was homophobia. I really experienced the worst homophobia I'd ever experienced at that time. It was a fearful time. I was still living in Leeds in a little house that I lived in. I get people knocking on my door. I got fans knocking on my door. I got the press knocking on my door. I got people knocking on my door, threatening in Leeds to bash me all the time,
because
to
you've
kill
been
me.
So visibly gay in your Top of the Pops.
You know, yeah, because I've been so uber gay in my, you know, in my Top of the Pops appearance, I decided just to kind of play it for you know, to go all the way on Top of the Pops.
Was that slightly a reaction to your record company?
It was a reaction to really annoy them, yeah, and to really kind of just be subversive and to really kind of create as much mischief. There was us and them. So we decided to go on Top of the Pops and make this kind of art. It was, we were still art students in our mind, making this artistic statement. So I wore black bangles. I kind of saw this picture by this New York socialite from the 30s called Nancy Cunard. And there's a photograph of her with all these bangles all the way down her arm. So I decided that was a great... So I wore all these kind of bangles and bracelets down my arm, all these black studs and black sort of things.
But it was quite S&M-y, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I decided to wear black eyeliner because I'd seen this... I loved Juliette Greco, the sort of French singer Juliette Greco. She had this black eye makeup on. And I'd seen this film called The Rebel with Tony Hancock, where he goes to stay with all these French existentialists who all wear black and they wear black eye makeup like this. I thought it was a great look. So I wore black and black eye makeup and it was a mixture of all those, mishmash of all those styles. The record company were appalled and just thought, oh my God, you just can't go on like that. You can't do that. This will be the end of your career. But I did. And because it was so extreme, it created this extreme thing with fans that just thought it was the best thing ever, a whole new sort of look that they hadn't seen before. It was out there and they related to it in their kind of alone in their bedrooms. And there are other people who just thought, we just want to murder these people.
Well, when you encountered that homophobia, people wanting to murder you, having grown up with some of this levelled at you from your dad and being fearful, did it play into old wounds?
I was terrified, actually, to be quite honest. The first thing of success is self-sell. And my PR people, who was a guy called Colin Bell, and Mariella Frostrup. I don't know if you know her from TV.
Yeah, I love her.
Yeah, she was my first PR people. And I liked Mariella a lot, but they said, you've got to invent girlfriends. We've got to have girlfriends for you. So they kept trying to invent all, have these girlfriends. I said, you must be seen out. Go out for... and meet Susie Sue because she wants to meet you and we can pretend that you're going out together.
So did you ever play along with that or no?
Well, I felt I kind of in a mischievously kind of did because I kind of felt, I just felt like absolutely completely out of my depth with the whole thing. So I didn't go out. I'm with a girlfriend or things like that. But I kind of felt it was kind of funny to be sort of, you know, that they would invent these kind of, and then I kind of met this kind of drug dealer from New York called Cindy Ecstasy. who was just a great friend, really, and then they saw that became like an invented girlfriend, and it was just the times that it was, you know. I had people, I had I remember going to people on TV taking the piss at Mickey out of me on TV. I remember I remember on Jukebox Jury that they bought it back at the early 80s, and they had an artist on who's remain nameless, got up and do this horrible homophobic impression of me and everything. And then you got Rowan Atkinson as well on Not the 9 o'clock News doing some kind of weird impressions of me. You got Russ Abbott at one point doing gay impressions of me. I just thought it was terrifying and kind of nastiness.
But interestingly, when you're encountering all this homophobia and it's hurting, you actually, your work becomes more explicitly gay and more challenging, and
I was kind of battling against the world in a way. And I think it's that unconscious thing that you want to do. They've got the record company on one side going, you've got to be less gay, you've got to be less gay, you've got to be less gay. But me kind of like, without wanting to say, wanting to show a kind of a strong sexual identity without actually saying it, if you see what I mean.
Can I ask you about the Sex Dwarf video, which is so notorious, this sexually explicit video that you made that was banned and is still banned now. So how did you get the money to do that from the record company if they were so against it and you were going, what was in it?
They didn't know it was being recorded. At the time, I think people were starting to make video albums at the time. It was something that was quite new.
Yeah.
We'd done a couple of... When we did videos for Bedsitter and those early... At Sailor of Goodbye, there were still the really early days of video, people making videos to go with their songs. The record company said, how would you like to make a video for the whole of Nonstop Erotic Cabaret? and everything. So we thought, this is great. So we made a little video for each song on Nonstop Already Cabaret. They kind of left us to it, really, because we were working with Tim Pope, who's a good director. We'd already had successful videos with him. They were great videos. And we just decided, it was just a moment of madness.
What was in it, though?
We kind of went around Soho and we got lots of kind of working girls from Soho. We got girls who were like sort of transsexuals, working girls, prostitutes basically. And we had dwarves with chainsaws. We had drag queens. We had all kinds of these in this video.
What were they all doing? Having sex?
Everyone was just running around, sort of in bondage outfits, and then sort of with chainsaws, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I'm running around virtually naked in like a black jock strap or something. And at one point, the director decided to throw buckets of blood and maggots all over everybody, and so without telling everyone. So there's maggots and blood running everywhere, and there were people running around with dwarves with chainsaws, people being strapped to tables. It was out there, it was a really out there video.
But again, it was really angry. It sounds quite angry.
We got raided by the police for that, and we got into a lot of trouble. It caused us a lot of grief, that video, because we still thought in our heads we were art students making a statement and everything. It was kind of angry, yeah, it was kind of angry. It was real punk thing that we were doing, kind of like against the corporate record company. And everything. Who were really just trying to do their best for us, really.
You know what? Another thing, actually, when you talk about being sexually out there and challenging, you were quite often slut shamed. You know, you talk about people doing impressions of you for being gay. Yeah. People also spread some horrible rumours about you and made up stories to bring you down.
Which we won't talk about because we know that they are extremely homophobic. It caused me a lot of upset that has over the years.
A lot of anger comes from
that as well, because, you know, we all know what we're talking about, but it's kind of born from the worst kind of homophobia.
Yeah.
And that was an example of the homophobia that I was having to go through at that time. In the media, and also, you know, people who are now still writing in the media now in papers, we're writing just terribly homophobic.
Just making things up about what you've
done sexually. Making things up about me.
Yeah.
And always passive things as well. Always things, you were always like some passive person, you know, who would be like
some puffy thing again.
They don't want to see you as a kind of a strong gay person. They want to see you as just a passive, weak, you know, down on your knees person.
Yeah,
and everything.
That's
what you are, just a receptacle, basically, and that's how it was kind of the most worst kind of homophobia I feel, and even now when I still bristle, you know, when somebody brought that up a while ago in something, I will walk out of an interview, walk out of a radio thing, walk out anyway if anyone ever brings that up, because I'm talking to you about it now.
Well, this is gay to gay.
We know what we're talking about.
And can I just say, I never would bring up the details. I was talking about slut shaming in general.
But it is slut shaming, yeah. It is slut shaming, and I think it's like I'd never presented a safe kind of gay image. I think I always presented. I'd like to think I presented a kind of a sexuality.
Yeah.
Whether that's changed now, I'm not so sure. But unless you're kind of neutered and clownish and sort of and you're still kind of acceptable because the straight community, whatever community, straight, a lot of people, heterosexual, the straight community, still don't like to think of what we term as the gay act.
Yes.
The act.
The anal sex act.
And that is the image that comes into their mind. A lot of gay people not everybody has anal sex. People do, people don't. But it's the image that comes into people's, it's the heterosexual, it's the image that heterosexuals find it harder to get over.
Well, can I say something, darling? Because there's on one hand, you've got the acceptable face of gayness, which is the gay clown, like you say, playing around, the people on Britain's Got Talent, and the camp fun, a bit of fun gay.
Which is actually quite homophobic.
Really.
But the
other thing is, you've got the heteronormative. Now that we can get married and integrate into society, you've got the heteronormative gays getting married and everything being well-behaved gays.
You're well-behaved.
And then what you get is slut-shaming against somebody like George Michael, who was very open about his non-conventional sexuality, non-conformist sexuality. Yeah. And because you'd been associated with that in the past, you know, people slut-shaming you for that.
Yeah.
And you do get gay-on-gay slut-shaming now, which I find really upsetting when people think, oh, you're giving us a bad name with the straights, you know, we should all be respectable now.
But you know what? There's the thing about that as well, which also, because the people, there's still a very down attitude within. I see, I don't really think there is much of a gay community anymore. I think it's so fractured. It's so fractured into. I'm not one a person who supports this. So many letters and so many. I can't even remember them. When I remember it being, I mean, it was all everybody together. We were all a bit on the outs, you know, on the peripheries of things, but we weren't all. We didn't have to have our own platform that we had to stand on. It was all everybody together. Everything. What I don't like is there's still a very down thing in the whatever you call the gay community. On feminine gay people, and I think that's very wrong. There's still a downer on that, you know. If people are very feminine or they're very camp, that's still a kind of they give us a bad name, you know.
Or they're slutty.
They're slutty.
Yeah,
and I think that's really, really wrong. It was really interesting when I was watching a BBC thing recently called Against the Law. Did you see that?
Yes, it was fantastic.
And the guy at the end, he talked to the Wolfenden report, and he said at the end, he said, "Yeah, there are three types of gay people. There's the kind of mentally ill gay people who are like effeminate and think they're kind of women and talk like women and things like that, and they're just mentally ill. And then there's like the kind of pederasts and paedophiles, and then there's the rest of everybody who's just normal gay people. That was then, that was in front of the Wolfenden report, but even now, still now, there is still that downness by a lot of gay people on what you would call the very camp gay man.
The femme ones, the passive ones, there's a real bottom shaming that goes on as well as slut shaming.
Yeah.
It's like you said, the stories that were thrown around about you were always about the being part of the passive act.
That is demonised,
you know, and it's terrible the way that happens. It's terrible.
But I don't define my sexuality either. I do define my sexuality as one or the other. I find I'm very kind of, I can be camp, I can be kind of everything, but I can be everything else as well. I can be other things as well. I'm very kind of fluid, I think, with the way I am sexually and where I behave sexually in different ways. I like to be camp sometimes, and sometimes I'm not camp. Sometimes I can be the opposite of camp.
But do you think...
I don't feel... I'm never trying to put myself into a kind of a category. I've tried to have always avoided that, or whether it's a natural thing or whatever. But I do think that's a really bad thing when I think the people who are very camp, very feminine gay man is almost the bravest gay man of all.
I agree. I think so.
Because they're the ones that are
on
really
the front line.
On the front line.
You can't pass.
And it's always been like that, I think. And it's always been looked down on, I think.
But also, you know, going back to the slut-shaming thing, when you think about it, the fact is that now we're allowed to get married and fully integrate into society. That's brilliant. But it has created this division between the good gays, the well-behaved gays, and the badly behaved gays.
Yeah, yeah.
The ones
who
are sexually non... You know,
the establishment gays, the ones that are, you know, and everything, and the badly behaved ones,
and sometimes that doesn't just come from mainstream straight society projecting it onto us. You also can get gay-on-gay shaming.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people saying you're giving us a bad name, you know, just wondered how you felt about that.
I do feel that happens a lot. I do feel that still happens a lot, and people there is that kind of very fracturedness. And maybe it's always been there, but I think it's always, you know, someone said to me, I was questioning why there was why we have a gay pride anymore. Someone said, why is there a gay pride? Someone put it to me quite clearly why there's a gay pride. It's the only time of the year where all those fractions all mix together in one big sort of mixed, big melting pot of different kind of gay people marching alongside each other in a big park together, a party, and you can see all those different kinds of people together, and that's that bring one time a year that it brings all those different fractions together. So I could see the point of that, but I do think there's always been that gay kind of snobbery.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is in the old days we were, you know, I talk about good gays and bad gays. In the old days we were all bad gays.
Yeah, all bad gays.
You know, we were just all lumped in together. Yeah. Whereas now you can be well-behaved gays or badly behaved gays, and it has.
If you're married, you're well-behaved. If you get married, you're well-behaved gay and everything. You're well-behaved. You're fitting into society. It's all a way so they can sort of fit you into establishment of society and file you away, basically.
So in that case, right, so having been angry in the past, having been really sexually out there, and now you've got this new album with a mainstream record company, which is lovely and happy and warm and joyful, where do you feel you fit in now? You've always had one foot in the mainstream, yeah. One foot in the underground. You've been, do you know what I mean? How do you feel you fit into the mainstream and the underground in the gay world and in the artistic world?
You know, I'm never really kind of... For sure, I've always thought I've been my own island in a way, in that way, in some ways. I never kind of move. You know, I mean, I feel this is a period of my life I'm going through. I'm going through a period of my life where I'm signed to a major record label. Certain things are expected of me. Then that will move out of that. Then other things will happen, and I'll move into maybe a non-mainstream world and things. So I don't know. I do kind of bridge those, kind of have both foot in those kind of things. I feel over the years I've kind of brought it together a lot more, and I've become. I said, at one time you can be anti-establishment and punk and all those things, and then eventually everybody becomes mainstreamed in the end. I think you do become because the people get used to you.
Just by
being around for so long, they get used to you, and they're used to the fact that you do sometimes odd things and sometimes commercial things. And I don't think there is so much thing anymore as commercial or non-commercial, pop or non-pop. You look at, you know, all kind of interesting pop, you know, unless you're talking about X Factor pop or things like that kind of manufactured sort of pop. A lot of pop, it kind of fits into different categories. You look at interesting artists like Perfume Genius, for example.
Love Perfume Genius, and
it's kind of like, is that pop or is it underground? It's kind of both.
But
it kind of fits into both, you know.
Isn't it fascinating that you made the Sex Dwarf video all those years ago, and you know it got you into all that trouble? Here we are now, 30 however many years later, in the offices of your major record company, celebrating the release of a mainstream major album, yeah. Talking about the Sex Dwarf video.
Yeah, isn't it? Life is full of irony. As it is.
I know.
You know it is. It is.
Well, for all of that and for being your own island, as you say,
thank you, yeah.
Mark Almond, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mark Almond there. And his new album, Shadows and Reflections, is out now on BMG. Time for a couple of quick thank yous. These podcasts are sponsored by the Great Britain Campaign, which welcomes the world to visit, do business, invest and study in the UK. Check out their website at great.gov.uk. And our co-sponsors are Jaguar. If you'd like more information on their products, then you can visit the website jaguar.co.uk or look out for them in the latest issue of Attitude magazine. I'll be back in a couple of weeks to let you know who my next special guest will be. For now, thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time on Attitude Heroes.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.